University.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another interview that I'm doing here. I have my buddy Black Horse on, who is based in Canada. And at the moment, there's a huge amount of talk all over Europe about Greenland, about Trump and foreign policy, about, I mean, I've been listening to a great deal of liberal mainstream media. And a lot of the talk is that Trump has lost it, basically, that Trump not only has lost it, he has kind of imbibed his own, like his own stuff, and everybody waiting for him to become normal again, right, or normality to return, or, you know, like in this country, Keir Starmer, it's like he's holding out for a moment that everything goes, quote unquote, back to normal. That's not going to happen. I mean, seriously, in the past couple of days, I've heard British generals on this radio station I listen to talking about US troops pulling out of Europe, being kicked out of the bases in Germany, the end of NATO, the prospect of what happens if Russia attacks. We can't count on Trump to defend. Just this morning, there was talk of Russia nuking Ramstein, right? In and this is not like kind of friend. This is a mainstream,
yeah.
Like these are mainstream voices, senior people who've worked at the highest levels of government saying this sort of stuff. So it's like the sky is falling down. Okay, and we're gonna, and the Canadian perspective is interesting because you're right there, and also Mark Carney has not actually taken the same tack as Keir Starmer and a lot of the European leaders, which has been to kowtow to Trump. He's like on the other way. He's kind of standing up to him. And that's what the conversation was this morning, all about, oh, well, is it time to fight back for the European leaders? Is it time to show a spine against America? And Gavin Newsom gave some interview saying, like, now's the time to fight back and all of this.
Well, not only that, Newsom also hosted a whole collection of foreign officials while he did this. So he was, you know, busy making his pedigree for president by showing his foreign policy expertise.
Mm-hmm. So, and then another talking point that, you know, has been, and we'll get into all of this and a lot more once we get started here. I'm just setting things up. Another big talking point this morning was that because all of this is so unprecedented, because nobody knows what the hell is happening, because Trump is so mercurial and unpredictable and erratic, there are simply no experts for this, because nobody knows what the hell is happening. Okay, so this is the kind of context that we're having this conversation. It's a very interesting time to have our Canadian friend on here. Before we get going, I'll just remind everybody, promo code SHORJAN is 25% off all of my courses for all of January. That runs up right until the 31st of Jan. Promo code SHORJAN. I'll spare you all the advert because you've seen it all 100 times at this point. If you give the receipt for Foundations of Shakespeare to the publisher of the book Foundations of Shakespeare, you'll get 50% off that as well. And Black Horse, where can people find you?
You can find my content at The Red Ensign at Substack, or you can find me at The Black Horse 65 on Twitter. I also have a YouTube presence under The Red Ensign.
Okay. And okay, so I've kind of given a sketch of the current situation as we're recording this. It's the 20th of January today. By the time you hear this, it'll probably be like the 21st or the 22nd. I mean, is the talk in the media in Canada as hysterical? I mean, I hesitate to say hysterical because it does actually seem like an existential crisis for NATO.
Yeah.
But the pitch is heightened at the moment in the media here. Are you seeing that there in Canada as well?
Yeah, although we're starting to get a little immune to it because this has been going on since the elbows up rally around the flag that Mark Carney incited some time ago. I also think that I don't understand the suddenness of the panic. A lot of what you're seeing in the near abroad in the Americas was all announced in the national security strategy by the U.S. government in December. There's a big discussion about how to be serious at the time, but we're now seeing the U.S. government act in ways which are entirely consistent with the strategy that they announced. And not only that, consistent with a position which has been held in the security state from the first Trump presidency through the Biden presidency and now through the second Trump presidency. So in Canada, my perspective is that the Carney government has been waiting for the U.S. to, quote, go back to normal, particularly on issues related to China, now for going on 7-8 years. And they don't seem to be able to reconcile themselves to the reality that the strategy of the global order led by the U.S. has changed, and they have to alter the way that they do business in order to reflect that strategy.
Are you suggesting, Black Horse, just to try to speak in clear terms here, that a leader like Carney or all the globalist leaders, all the European leaders, are expecting that once it's a Democrat back in, things will go back to normal, quote unquote, and that this is all just wrapped up with the weird figure of Donald Trump, right? As opposed to this is actually American deep state, quote unquote, strategy, i.e. this is coming from the military industrial complex. This is actually it's wrapped in the clothing of Trump, but this is actually America doing this. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. The vast majority of the Canadian establishment has predicated its strategy on both trade and defense policy, quote, going back to normal, which I think is a total misreading of what's actually going on here.
So why don't you outline in broad terms what you think is actually going on right now?
So if you look at the national security strategy, which was announced in December, and look backward to a consistent pattern of actions, which is the U.S. security state attempting to decouple both itself and its near abroad from China as a consequence of the failed policy to integrate China into the global order, which prevailed between 1990 and maybe 2014, 2015. A lot of the interventions that you're seeing going on, either that have already occurred or that are being contemplated, are designed to compel the near abroad states within the American sphere of influence to follow the U.S. lead and begin the process of decoupling. Whether that's the decapitation strike, which was attempted in Venezuela, whether that is the change in State Department policy toward the fractured government in Mexico, whether it is the all the rhetoric in Canada concerning trafficking as an issue. Every time you hear the U.S. government talk about trafficking, they're really talking about Chinese influence, economic and political, in that country. So when they're talking about trafficking as an issue in Venezuela, what they're really talking about is the Venezuelan government's association with the Chinese government, who they're attempting to blame for the fentanyl crisis in the United States. I don't really have a view as to whether or not the Chinese government has a lot to do with the fentanyl trade in the United States. But I certainly have the view that the primary reason for trying to extricate them from the near abroad in the U.S. is not fentanyl. It is the strategic imperative of being able to have a great power competition well enmeshed with China in the way that they have been previously. And so when you look at the policy towards Canada, even when you look at the policy towards Greenland, the justification for the policy towards Greenland on paper is wanting to have U.S. bases there and wanting to economically exploit Greenland. This is obviously not correct. If the U.S. wanted additional bases in Greenland under the terms of the NATO treaty, under the representations made by the government of Denmark, they could have them tomorrow morning. If the U.S. wanted to make investments to develop resources in Greenland, they could trivially do that under existing trade agreements. They could also renegotiate the trade arrangement with Denmark in order to get better terms. What they can't do under the current arrangement is they can't prevent the government of Greenland from allowing Chinese investment in the area, and they cannot assure that the status quo as it is today will be the status quo 20 years from now, when on an economic basis they're less readily able to compete for those resources with China, at least in their own mind.
Now, what's interesting here, and again, this morning I heard various talking heads from the British establishment and the European establishment. There was some guy from Germany there. This was the guy you mentioned. He's a PhD, some professor, you know, who talked about Russia nuking Ramstein as the first target, right? And he was genuinely talking about getting the Americans out of there because they now represent a security threat rather than a security guarantee. And he was talking about basically Europe and the quote-unquote global south. They call it the community of democracies, okay? Yes. So that's basically any country in the third world, quote-unquote global south, that's friendly to the West, okay? They're basically talking now seriously about doing globalism without America.
Yeah, they're talking about this in Canada as well. This is like the Carney strategy of deeper trade integration with both the EU and China is hard to articulate it any other way than globalism without America. But the plan seems, I mean, maybe it makes a little bit more sense in Europe. In Canada, this seems completely insane.
Yeah, I mean, I've been struggling to make sense of the whole, I mean, I've called it before the Mark Carney paradox. Let me just lay out what that is. Canada, as a country, has basically no military to speak of. I mean, I'm sure there is a Canadian army, but if America becomes an actual threat, okay, I don't think anybody, you don't have to be like a Napoleon or something to figure out that America could probably take Canada, right, in any kind of war. It also does not have financial leverage over America. It's a trading partner, but it's obviously the junior trading partner, given the sheer size, population, GDP, etc., of America. So on paper, I look at it and I say, well, if it's Trump versus Carney, Trump holds most of the cards, right? But Carney does not behave like that. Carney has consistently acted as if he holds all the cards. He stood up to Trump. He's been like, right, the only way to deal with a bully is to stand up to them and to fight back. And he has been defiant. He has not backed down on virtually anything. He talks a good game. You know, he's getting into bed visibly with the Chinese now. He's basically defying Trump across the board. This is a dangerous game for Carney, isn't it?
It's completely insane. So in Carney's internal worldview, standing up to Trump is actually good for Canada's relationship with the United States, because when the true emperor returns, he will reward me, basically. So when Blue America returns to ascendancy in Washington, he expects to be rewarded for his defiance against the Red Emperor, the Red Usurper. This strategy is entirely based on the idea that Trump is a rogue element in American politics. And I don't believe that. I believe that Trump is a continuation of governance by the American deep state. That many of the changes, there's going to be some kayfabe discard of Trump. I think a lot of us would anticipate that. But, and you may even see elements of rewarding international opponents of Trump as part of that kayfabe discard. But a lot of these, particularly in the area of foreign policy, there are key elements of the new national security strategy. There are key elements of the policies that are being pursued here that are going to continue because they're consistent with the long-term priorities of the American deep state. The other thing that I think is very interesting here is that Trump has for a long time struggled with elements in the American state who have not wanted to rearticulate the relationship with NATO, particularly uncooperative elements in his own party. It is possible that part of the style with which the Greenland issue in particular is being addressed is intended to compel the Europeans to do what Congress will not, and that is to alter the terms of NATO indelibly.
But, I mean, see, this is what's very confusing for me. If it is a continuity American deep state agenda, and I should mention these various liberal elites, let's call them European liberal elites and British liberal elites on LBC, which is the channel, you know, my car is permanently stuck on. The sorts of conversations they've been having in the past couple of days have been saying, like, look, this is the end of NATO. We can no longer trust America as an ally, period. And, you know, they were having this conversation on how to get back at Trump. And they were saying, like, look, this is the wrong way to look at it. It's not a case of going after Trump and his golf courses and, you know, picking a personal battle with him. Any sanction from Europe has to come to America per se, like to America in general.
Yes. So
they're actually treating this seriously. And two more things I want to say on this. One of the really confusing things for me is that NATO is the American empire. Like, NATO is America's power. Yeah. So I just don't get this drive to drive a wedge between America and essentially its most loyal vassal states. And then the last thing I'll say is that these liberal elites were also saying, like, look, we need to actually appeal to the real power in America, which was, and they used the exact term, the military-industrial complex in Washington. So there's a plan now being hatched, you know, by the likes of Macron and Starmer to directly appeal to the military-industrial complex, quote-unquote, to say, look, you know, this Greenland stuff is really causing a problem. I'll give you an example of the sort of trouble that Trump is causing, okay? In a press conference just yesterday, he said, we have to take Greenland, okay? America has to acquire Greenland because Russia represents a security threat, okay? And we've told Denmark for the past 20 years that you need to do something about it. They haven't done it. We need to come in and take direct control, okay, because of the Russian security threat. In the next sentence, Black Hawk, okay, I mean, we're talking like minutes later, he invited Vladimir Putin to sit on his new board of peace with Tony Blair, in the same breath. So, like, anybody watching that is like, what? We're through the looking glass. Like, America is not a proper, normal country anymore. It's behaving through Trump, through this mouthpiece, in a very rogue and weird way. It, on the one hand, it's saying Russia's a threat. On the other hand, he's inviting Putin to the board of peace. Like, what the hell's going on?
Well, I mean, that's consistent with the Cold War stand that that the United States took with respect to the Soviet Union or with respect to China during the Cold War, right? They were consistently invited to be partners on talks on issues of international significance. So I don't think it's at all unexpected for Putin or for Xi to sit on the board of peace for the Israel-Gaza situation at the same time as they're considered rivals preparing for a contest of strength.
Sorry to come back, Black Horse. From the perspective of anybody in NATO, we're already in a hot war with Russia in Ukraine. I mean, we have personnel there. They fund it. They've given billions upon billions of dollars of weapons to Ukraine in a hot war with Russia right now.
Right. So, but the U.S. has a long history of entering vassal states into hot wars with opponents, and then allowing those vassals to pay the consequences of entering a hot war that they can't win, right? Mm-hmm. Ask the people of Vietnam about entering a hot war with the other side of the Cold War on behalf of the United States, and what happens when the United States decides they no longer want to be participants in that war. Mm-hmm. This has happened repeatedly, and I think, unfortunately for the people of Ukraine, I think they're about to be learn what the Kurds have learned repeatedly in the Middle East, that the United States has its own agenda and will decide for itself when it's good and when it's bad to pursue a particular war. And, you take it on as a partner at your own peril.
Yeah. And I should mention in one of these same conversations, I was listening to one of these talking heads and I couldn't quite believe my ears. Right. They said, basically Russia's not a threat at the moment because our plan is working, you know, to slowly bleed them out. You know, yes, it's at the cost of Ukrainian lives, but, you know, we're getting Russia to bleed out in this, you know, bogged down in this war. Therefore, they're not actually a threat right now. So it gives us a chance to tool up, basically, and deal with both them and eventually the Americans. Can't believe these sorts of conversations are happening in broad daylight now. But anyway, carry on, Black Hawk.
Yeah, I mean, the other point that I want to make is that if you read the National Security Strategy, it's very skeptical of the long-term future of Europe as partners with the United States on security. I think that we'll talk about this a little bit in the episode ahead on the U.S. dollar, but there seems to be some disconnect in American strategy over what it's actually going to do with its European vassals. I don't think that the policy is quite coherent in this regard. So I think that the whether it's Canada, whether it's some of the NATO vassal states, the policy's gotten very exploitive. The Americans don't seem to consistently understand the way that the relationship exactly works. And I think they may not understand because some of the rivalries between different elite groups in the United States have gotten pretty intense, and they kind of perceive their sectional interests ahead of a consistent national interest.
Right.
I
should mention that in these elite conversations that go on, because much of the media, the liberal media, is just elites talking to each other, right? This talking point of Donald Trump's that America pays for Europe security is being roundly rebuffed. Quite like they're saying, no, actually, we pay for that. The way the relationship works is that we pay. It's actually European tax dollars that go into paying for all those bases, and also because of the debt relationship and all the rest of it. And that argument is being made. What I'm saying is it's being made to the general public that America is actually the one having the ride, not the other way around, as Donald Trump presents it. And of course, he has brought, with his rhetoric, he has brought that issue to the fore. So, you know, there's currently a kind of, how can I say, like a European reawakening, a kind of an awareness of exactly what the security relationship is and the fact that it is exploitative on America's part, and that now they're starting to be perceived as a kind of occupying or tyrannical hegemon, something like this. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, I mean, we see this in Canada as well, where the policy from the American government, which increases the level of exploitation on its vassal states, has created this this effort among kind of neoliberal, you know, pretty disgusting creatures who in a lot of other ways are pretty servile to US interests. they've launched very public campaigns to try to defend the status quo. I'm not quite sure how this is going to go at this point, except that I don't think that this goes away as a consequence of the return of Blue America to ascendancy in the United States, if that even occurs. Like, I don't think it's guaranteed that that occurs. But in either eventuality, I see the escalation of exploitation as American deep state policy and therefore enduring between administrations. And I think you're going to see greater hostility between the vassal states and the imperial core as a characteristic of this period.
Yeah, I mean, there's two things I want to, before we close up here, there's two things I want to get to here. The first thing is the impact on the right in America, the right in Europe, the right in Canada. But before we get to that, I mean, I wrote a book called Prophets of Doom. I've studied the cycles of empires, okay? And one of the things that I observe is that late empire, I mean, the British Empire had its own moment like this, but there are lots of examples from history. I can only describe it as a kind of spaz out towards the end, right? Where you realize the thing is on the downwards swing, right? It's in decline. The end is coming. And yet, in order to G themselves up or give themselves confidence, there's almost like a kind of last hurrah, okay? For the British Empire, this actually happened, between the wars, after World War One, right? Which I would argue is the beginning of the end of the British Empire, really. But it actually reached its apex in the 1920s. And there, you know, there was a kind of spirit. There was this character called John Bull, yeah. Right? There was almost like a kind of British MAGA, if that makes any sense, like a make the British Empire great again mood in the 20s and the 30s, whereby, you know, and it really, the real final death throes of it was like crushing the Mau Maus in 1960 or something like that, which where then we were truly at the end. You understand what I'm saying, right? It kind of like, from the point of view of 1922, the empire was going onwards and upwards. There was a great confidence in the air. Yes, we can smash those fuzzy wuzzies and all that sort of stuff, okay? But of course, it was too late by that point because the British Empire was on the way out. And to me, I think Trump and MAGA and all of this stuff that we're seeing is basically the beginning and the end of the American empire. It's kind of having its final spaz out, in my view. But is that the way you see it, Black Horse?
Yeah, and speaking as a colonial, the attitude in Canada between the wars actually very closely mirrors this period, where there's a big set of domestic concerns about the increasing level of exploitation from the British. There is an attempt to turn toward the United States, their rival in this period, for more support. There's a rearguard action from conservatives, of course, who side with the British Empire. So the experience in Canada is essentially identical in the 20s and 30s to the experience in the 2020s and going forward, where you have the conservatives caught unpopular siding with the imperial master. In this country right now, the Conservative Party of Canada has a domestic political problem because every time Donald Trump says 51st state or talks about tariffs or talks about taking Greenland, everybody remembers that the Conservative Party has, from the 1980s forward, been the party of deeper integration between the United States and Canada. And so every time that the United States says something which is politically unpopular in Canada, it damages the Conservative Party and actually reinforces the hegemony of the existing elite structure here.
Yeah, no, I mean, just this morning, this kind of shit-lib radio host, James O'Brien, went on a massive rant about a piece that conservative writer Richard Littlejohn had written in the Daily Mail, okay? and the headline goes, Trump should raise his sights from Greenland and buy Britain instead. I take him, warts and all, over our hopeless, complete and utter lawyer of a prime minister any day, okay? And O'Brien was comparing this Little John to Lord Haw-Haw. He was saying, this is a traitor. This is, you know, ridiculous, treasonous language at a time where we need to stand up to America. I agreed with him, to be honest. I agreed with O'Brien. I was like, who is this horrible, spineless Tory boy, essentially, okay? And I was interested because Morgoth actually made a tweet about that exact same Daily Mail article. So something remarkable has happened. Donald Trump has engineered a situation where the European online right, or certain vocal elements of it, have started to side with the neoliberal center. I mean, I don't agree with James O'Brien on anything, Black Horse. You know, you listen to my show. He's so annoying, you have to turn it off, okay, on most weeks. And yet, I didn't disagree with anything he said in about 2 hours, because from a British point of view and from a European point of view, that article from Little John is downright, you know, it's a dereliction. You're siding with a hostile foreign power, okay, against, I mean, okay, I don't like Keir Starmer, but if it comes down to it, I'm not going to cheer on foreign occupation or takeover by Trumpist America. So this is causing a problem, and it's actually created a moral unity between even the populist parties. Maloney and Farage and Le Pen have had to fall in behind Starmer and Macron on this. They've had to fall in because this has 0% popularity. I mean, other than some online nutters, okay, who may be getting paid by the Americans or whatever, this has no purchase at all in Europe, because the geostrategic interests of Europe and of Britain are what they are, right, regardless of who the president is. So, yeah, I mean, this is causing a problem, Black Horse.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very delicate situation in Canada, because you're correct all the way down about when you're threatened by a foreign power, you can't be seen domestically siding with that foreign power instead of siding with your own elite. And there's layers on which that's true. Like on the first layer, you know, that's not my political preference, but on the second layer, it can be extremely dangerous to do so. Because who knows how these politics evolve, especially in a place like Canada, where politics are getting very real. There's very real separatist politics in the country right now. The economic prospects for the country are very poor because of the declining relationship with the United States. You could find yourself in a very, very difficult position personally for siding with the Americans in this conflict, especially in the short term. Mm. At the same time, unlike Europe, where if you imagine a future where Great Britain successfully expels the American military presence, it's pretty unlikely that there will be military repercussions from the United States for Britain pursuing that policy, at least. Or at least it seems to me pretty unlikely. Whereas if Canada actually does break its security partnership with the United States, there's no way the Canadian government will be allowed to persist in that policy. The border between Canada and the United States is utterly indefensible, which means it can only exist if there is a tight security partnership between Canada and the United States. If Canada pursues the line you're discussing, Canada will cease to exist as a nation in its current political construction. So it's a delicate line for Canadians to walk during this period. I made a series of episodes of my own show discussing the various pitfalls of navigating what I call the late imperial moment. And in my mind, it is a very delicate operation, and if Canada comes through this period without being forever changed, I would be somewhat surprised. It would be an impressive feat of geopoliticking.
One of the worries I have, Black Horse, is that all of this is going to give the ammunition, evidence, experience for Blue America, for the neoliberal center in every country in the West, basically just to put the right away for a generation.
That's correct. Because,
I mean, that's what I see coming down the pike. I've just written a column along. I mean, it was one of those columns I wrote, and I was like, maybe this one won't get published because it's so like pessimistic. But I mean, I can just see it coming, because if I was a shitlib right now, I'd be thinking, they've basically been proven right on a lot of stuff, right? All of this, I mean, one of the things O'Brien was talking about is like, oh, all the people who said Trump, you know, never means what he says and all this sort of stuff. Like, he was saying, I've been true blue from day one. All these people about Brexit and about Trump and so on, they lie to you and blah, blah, blah. Now our democratic norms are being eroded. Now NATO's in trouble, blah, blah, blah. They're feeling vindicated. And I'm inclined to look at what's happened and think, well, you've got a point, you know, like they, you know, whatever moral high ground the right, quote unquote, have. I mean, it's been basically been pissed away in the past year. And in the past month, some of the behavior that we've seen, some of the kind of mob mentality and so on. I mean, it's when Trump sits in the Oval Office and says he puts morality, his own morality above the law and this sort of stuff. It's like, well, the ammo is there, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
If you get a Gavin Newsom or somebody like that as president, he would have casus belli to put the right away, and then all the other governments would have more than enough ammo.
Yeah,
especially on, I mean, this is why I've been telling people on Twitter, you're posting up a storm, but you're not actually creating anything, and you're also giving the security state every means necessary to come after you if and when the winds change, if and when there's another vibe shift, Black Horse.
Well, and look at what's going on in Australia today. I fully expect that and more to come in Canada, where, particularly because there are separatist politics in the country, you know, you want to understand when security states really go hammer and tongs after people. It's when you threaten the integrity of the state. You know, the last time Canada was in this precarious political situation in the 1970s, Trudeau the Elder put tens of thousands of Canadian troops on the streets of Ottawa and Montreal and arrested thousands of people at random during the FLQ crisis. And so people need to be very careful. As I say, the situation in Europe may well be a little bit different, but I fully expect the Canadian state to have a moment here where it goes full repressive tolerance and takes a lot of political prisoners.
Just before we wrap up, I noticed that there hasn't been that much market movement over all of this, which is a little bit surprising given how turbulent it's been. Why doesn't the city care about any of this?
Well, because if the financial markets are anticipating that there is no geopolitical change that can take place in this moment, which will disrupt American hegemony inside the empire, at least not in the short term.
Right. What would have to happen for the markets to really move?
You would have to see real evidence that the Europeans or other vassal states can actually send the American troops home, right? Because it's one thing for the British Prime Minister to say we're going to send the American troops home and go in a new direction. It's another thing to actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen repeatedly in the history of the American Empire, various nations in Europe attempt to kind of change course, and we have never, the market basically doesn't believe that this is possible.
Interesting. Very interesting. I've noticed that, how can I say, like, so altered is the relationship that talking points that I've never heard articulated in mainstream media are kind of making it to the airwaves. For example, when they were having that chat earlier on, they mentioned that Eisenhower or JFK, if Russia had attacked Europe, would not have actually put American troops on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. That's what they were saying. So they were saying, like, if that was the case, the chance of Trump doing it is almost zero. The fact that even talking about that and bringing it to people's attention, to me, is very noticeable.
Well, they're correctly identifying the U.S. Army in Europe as an occupation force rather than as a defense force. Mm. And to hear that is a talking point that has existed in our spaces for quite some time. But to hear that out of the mouths of the liberal mainstream is very strange.
Very strange indeed. Started making me wonder, like, maybe we were all mislabeled as dissident or rightist or whatever. Maybe we're just like the avant-garde of the shit-lib center or something. Just saw things coming before they happened or something like this. But it's, very weird time. But, I mean, my view is that when it's so turbulent like this, it would be a mistake, I think, to go all in. You know, if you're a British patriot or a Canadian patriot or a German one or a French one, it just, like, it seems just the wrong time to go all in on Trump, or, you know, it's just the wrong moment, I think, to...
Well,
we this can't be with MAGA right now. We just can't be.
This November, I wrote a series of pieces chronicling the life of Arthur Currie, who was a Canadian general during the First World War, one of the most successful generals of the First World War, and responsible in significant part for Canada's participation in what was called the 100 Days Offensive, during which he took enormous casualties, but achieved incredible victories on behalf of the British Empire. In his own frame, he thought that he was doing, his view was that power in Canada was attached to the British imperial apparatus and he would be rewarded for this. Instead, he spent within a year of returning home, he faced a court-martial and was accused of treason from Parliament. He spent the rest of his life fighting libel suits, arguing that he sacrificed Canadian lives needlessly, and died in very close to disgrace, was initially denied a military funeral, denied internment in what is the most prestigious military cemetery. He did get a military funeral. But the reason I wrote the piece is to identify, like, in these late imperial moments, it is very delicate, the balance between doing your duty to the existing political order and maintaining a correct view to the interests of your own people.
Yeah, lots to think about. I mean, I don't think anybody has the answers right now. I also think that if this is like American deep state policy, as you surmise, to me, a lot of it just seems random and reckless. It just seems like, I mean, if this is what, it doesn't seem, I mean, maybe it's just the personality of Trump or something. To me, it seems random and reckless rather than, you know, deeply planned. And, you know, I mean, they're doing lasting damage to themselves and to everybody else. No?
I mean, from their point of view, they think that they're retrenching the empire, right? They think that this is Hadrian withdrawing from the extremities of the empire, refortifying. And they think that the most important thing that's going on right now is successfully decoupling from China and preventing the Chinese from supplanting them as at the head of the rules-based international order, right? Mm. That's what they think they're doing. Obviously, it looks a little bit different in Europe because certain European countries may well find themselves sacrificed beyond the walls, beyond the new frontiers. And, that's a very difficult position to find yourself in.
So interesting. Well, we live in interesting times, Black Horse. I'll just remind people, pick up Courses Academic Agency, promo code Shorjan. And where can people find you again?
The Red Ensign Substack, or on Twitter at the Black Horse 65. I also have a YouTube channel, The Red Ensign.
Fantastic. Well, so long for now, everyone.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.